Welcome to the Science Podcast for January 27th, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, a co-evolution study in the laboratory, the relationship between locusts and livestock, and the next frontier in supercomputing. Plus, as usual, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Because evolution occurs on vast timescales, scientists must often look to the high turnover lifestyles of bacteria and viruses to watch it in action. In a co-evolution experiment, Justin Meyer and colleagues observed mutations in a phage virus that allowed it to overcome a mutation in its host that was blocking infection. Meyer spoke with me about how this battle in a test tube addresses the larger question of the way organisms gain complex new functions through evolution.
My co-authors and I were interested in how organisms evolve novel functions. This is a big question in evolutionary biology that has very little data for how it happens. We had previously studied how a virus, phage lambda, co-evolves in a laboratory setting, and we set out to start an experiment where we expected to see phage lambda evolve to do something new. And sure enough, we found that phage lambda evolves a novel ability to enter the cell through a new pathway.
Before we get into the details of this paper, I'd like to talk about some of the broad questions that you try to address. For example, how do complex adaptations arise? Can you set the problem up for us?
Absolutely, because it's certainly what inspired this experiment. Since the beginning of evolutionary biology, when Darwin proposed his theory of evolution by natural selection, there's really been a problem in explaining how organisms evolve new functions. It's clear that natural selection can cause populations to improve function, but how do species or populations make transitions to exploit new resources, invade new environments, make these very significant changes in the history of life? We set out to test whether or not natural selection had a role in driving the evolution of the virus to perform a new function, and we also tested alternative hypotheses, such as whether or not genetic drift, another evolutionary process, was responsible for the change.
And genetic drift is like a random mutation that accumulates in the population?
Absolutely. So we're all very familiar with natural selection and how the survival of the fittest will lead to evolutionary change. But because we have finite population sizes, there's this effect of random genetic drift where mutations arise and for just completely stochastic reasons will fix in the population and can actually change the phenotype of the population.
So in this experimental design that you used, you really had a lot of control over your population and its environment. You could freeze all the parties in place, sequence their genomes, and then even create new combinations to investigate. Can you describe your basic setup for us?
So I've described that we've studied phage lambda. Phage lambda is actually not a virus that infects humans. It's a virus that infects bacteria. Normally, we think of bacteria as causing human disease, but in our study, the bacteria are actually the victims. We chose this system rather than sort of a more natural or a human-based system because we're able to have a lot more control over the experimental settings, and we're actually able to test hypotheses in a much deeper way than if we were to use other systems. Because we're watching bacteria and viruses evolve with one another, we're able to actually monitor evolution in real time. They have very short generation times and large population sizes, so we can actually see mutations arise and see them evolve and shape the coevolution of the phage and the bacteria. Also, since we're using microbes, we can replicate the experiment many times over. And so a key feature of this paper is that we were able to replicate the experiment 96 separate times. Initially, when we ran the study, we only saw the virus evolve this trait once, but when we repeated it 96 separate times, 24 out of the 96 replicates were positive, and we saw the virus evolve this novel function.
So in your study, you looked at how a virus changed in what was basically a starvation scenario. The viruses were unable to infect their normal host, the bacteria, via their normal receptor. How long did it take for the viruses to overcome this barrier?
One of the amazing things that we found is that on average, in all of those 24 replicates, the virus evolved this novel function within 12 days. So this is extremely fast evolution. And what we found is that the reason why it was so fast and the reason why it happened so many times is that natural selection was really driving the evolution and driving the fixation of the mutations responsible for this new function.
And you also mentioned that these same mutations or similar ones arose in repeated experiments. And what does that mean for how evolution works or adaptation works in this case?
Yeah, so we call this parallel evolution. And this is when we see the same types of change happen again and again. And really, parallel evolution is a hallmark of natural selection. So while the genomes are acquiring random mutations, there's a select few that are really good for the fitness of the phage. And so those are selected by natural selection, and that's why we see the same ones reemerging time and time again. We also have other signs of natural selection in our experiment. So the mutations are biased towards ones that should affect phenotypic change.
Mm-hmm.
When we see a signature where the mutation should affect phenotypic change, then we know that there's some sort of bias towards changing function or changing phenotype, which is a signature of natural selection as well.
You also found that while the phage were changing, the bacterial hosts were also evolving to combat this infection. Can you tell us about that?
So we set up our experiment so we could watch a virus or examine how a virus evolved a novel function. What we didn't know we would end up testing is why sometimes that virus would evolve a novel function and other times it wouldn't. In our experiment, we allowed the phage and the bacteria to co-evolve with one another. And we designed it so that the first step that the bacteria took, the first mutation acquired, it would downregulate LAMB, the normal receptor for the virus.
Mm-hmm.
When this happens, it basically closes the door on the virus. So mutations that allow the virus to access new possible doors, in our experiment it was OMPF, those mutations would fix, and that would constitute the virus evolving a novel function. What we found is that while that was going on, sometimes the bacteria would mutate in another way so that it defended itself not from the outside, but within the cell. So this is the equivalent of a bacteria sort of evolving a guard dog that stops the DNA from the virus from entering the cell and reproducing and taking over the cell. When this happens, it shuts down the evolutionary process so that if the virus were to mutate and enter a new door, it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't see a benefit because its DNA would still be stopped. So under this scenario, when the second defense mutation evolves in the bacteria, then it shuts down the coevolutionary process, and we don't see the outcome of lambda evolving a new function or to target OMPF, the second doorway.
Because if it could bind to a new receptor, it wouldn't matter because it would be stopped. So there's nothing to encourage that happening.
Absolutely.
Okay.
What happens is that selective advantage that would be given to that mutation no longer exists in that environment where the host has this double protection. The host is really guiding how the phage evolves. And why we are so interested in figuring this out is that Stephen Jay Gould and some other great evolutionary biologists had long talked about how there's contingency in evolutionary biology, how if you replay the tape of time, you would not necessarily get the same outcome. If we replayed the history of life on Earth, we probably wouldn't get humans. While this is not anywhere near that time scale, it's a small time scale that we can study, and we see that the outcome of the experiment is contingent, and it's contingent not on how the virus is evolving, but how it's co-evolving with its host and interacting with its host.
Well, Justin Meyer, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Justin Meyer is the author of a research article on coevolution in a virus and its host in this week's Science.
For many of us, the word locust may elicit the shivers or conjure up images of biblical wrath. But for those with agricultural livelihoods, locust outbreaks evoke fears of economic damage. It is conventionally held that locusts thrive on diets rich in nitrogen and protein, but Ariane Cease of Arizona State University and her colleagues report the opposite. Environments that have experienced heavy livestock grazing, and hence nitrogen and protein depletion, are in fact preferred by locusts. Cease spoke with me about the implications of this study from Arizona.
The focus of the study was to understand the nutritional factors that cause the buildup of locust populations leading to outbreaks. And in this case, heavy livestock grazing leads to nitrogen-depleted soils, nitrogen-poor plants, and ultimately a degraded nutritional environment, which turns out to be just what this locust needs to thrive.
So why do we care about locust outbreaks?
Well, in the U.S. and much of Europe, we may think of locust plagues as a biblical reference. Locust outbreaks and swarms still have devastating effects on agriculture today, especially in developing countries in Asia and Africa. For example, during an outbreak year, locusts can populate over 20% of the Earth's land surface, negatively affecting more than 60 countries and the livelihood of 1 out of every 10 people. And chemical control measures cause significant human health problems and other non-target effects. So working to develop land management strategies that decrease incidence of outbreaks will have tremendous benefits for the stability of human food supply in many regions of the world, while simultaneously reducing secondary effects of pesticides on wildlife.
Wow. And for this study in particular, you were looking at the locusts that live in the grasslands of Inner Mongolia, a region that's actually part of China. Why did you choose this part of the world?
Globally, grasslands cover 25% of the total land area, and they're important areas of ecological research. And the vast semi-arid region of Central Eurasia, which includes Inner Mongolia, makes up the largest continuous grassland in the world. There was an ongoing collaboration between Arizona State University and researchers from the Chinese Academy of Sciences, who had a great research area called the Inner Mongolia Grassland Ecosystem Research Station in the rural steppe of northeast China, which made these large field experiments possible. At the same time, NSF has a program called East Asia and South Pacific Institutes that promotes graduate students to form U.S.-China collaborations. So it was through these ties and funding that this study really got off the ground.
And what are the locust outbreaks like in these grasslands?
They're pretty impressive. The first year that I went in 2008, there was an outbreak near the research station that had about 100 or more locusts per square meter.
Now, as you say in your paper, these grasslands see quite a lot of livestock grazing. And as you just said, they also have some pretty spectacular locust outbreaks. So how did you set out to sort of zoom in on cause and effect here?
Well, our starting hypothesis was that locusts form swarms partly to escape deteriorating conditions and seek out better food sources. It's been accepted for most herbivores, including insects, that protein is generally a limiting nutrient and plants with high protein are better food. Therefore, we began by fertilizing plots with nitrogen, predicting that this would cause locusts to survive and grow well and perhaps refrain from swarming.
And this is because the nitrogen that's found in plants is generally in the form of protein?
Yeah, and so to our surprise, locusts on nitrogen-fertilized plots grew more slowly and tended to die. We then tested their host plant selection and found that these locusts prefer to eat plants low in nitrogen. And getting back to the grazing, we then asked, how does this relate to the ecology of outbreaks? Well, it's been known for some time that overgrazing causes soil erosion, as you mentioned, leading to nitrogen depletion from the soil and reductions in the protein level of plants. So we next tested how these locusts responded to grazing levels. Indeed, these locusts preferred to eat the low-protein plants from heavily grazed plots, and these heavily grazed plots had many more locusts than ungrazed areas.
So what you actually observed here was that locusts prefer a diet with less nitrogen, which is the opposite of your hypothesis. You attribute this to the protein, but I'm curious about the other factors. Could there be other variables at play here, like other chemical effects of the fertilizer or even a change in taste or texture depending on the nitrogen content?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, many things can change with nitrogen fertilization in field plants. For example, they can accumulate toxins or new predators can arise and so on. So we tested the effect of different protein to carbohydrate levels on the growth of this locust using chemically defined diets, which are a mix of casein, sugars, cellulose, and vitamins. We gave the locust the choice of two bowls, one with low protein, high carbohydrate, and the other bowl the converse, high protein and low carbohydrate. The locust selected the preferred amount of each macronutrient by mixing between these two bowls, and then we measured how much they ate of each. You can do this with many different organisms using different pairs of diets, and remarkably, they always select for a target ratio of these macronutrients. Even more remarkably for this study, this locust had a lower protein to carbohydrate intake target than any other grasshopper or locust previously studied.
Now, it sounds like these results surprised you. How did they reflect the other research going on right now in this greater field of study?
Yes, I agree. This was a very interesting and surprising outcome. However, our results fit with an emerging paradigm that related animal species can vary dramatically in response to dietary variation, and that species with extreme intake targets, such as this locust, may be most sensitive to environmental variation. And the finding that this locust has a particularly low protein to carbohydrate intake target may explain why dramatic populations of outbreaks occur in association with changes in land management, and in this case, grazing intensity. I think another interesting point is that high-protein diets have been shown to decrease lifespan in a number of insects, including fruit flies. And other studies have also shown that most omnivores, including humans, will readily overeat carbohydrates but will not overconsume protein, sort of the Atkins diet effect. And we don't know yet how high nitrogen or protein has these negative effects, and I think that's an exciting area of research.
Okay, so we've tied livestock grazing to soil erosion to depletion of nitrogen and protein, all of which make for a happier and healthier locust. Now, what do you think the world of agriculture should take away from this study?
One of the things that this study shows is that research on the basic science of insects, such as their feeding preferences and ecology, can have real-world impacts on agriculture and global food supply, and it's important to fund these types of studies. We already knew that overgrazing was a problem that can lead to desertification, and this study provides us with a new understanding of how overuse of such grasslands can cause locust outbreaks and destruction, not only in the local area, but in surrounding agriculture as well. The study also suggests that we should be investigating nitrogen fertilizer as an alternative pest control for the species.
Good to know. Ariane Cease, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ariane Cease and colleagues discussed the interplay among livestock grazing, nitrogen, and locust outbreaks in a report this week.
Computers may seem to be shrinking, as evidenced by ever smaller consumer electronics like smartphones and tablets. But at the other end of the scale, researchers, governments, and industry are striving to create the largest computers in the world, exascale supercomputers. I spoke with Science's Robert Service about the challenges and the benefits of taking supercomputers to the next level.
This is a story about supercomputers and what it's going to take for researchers to make the next major leap in computing power.
Great. So getting into the details here, in the title, I think you call it exascale computing. Can you tell us what exascale means?
Absolutely. So the performance of computers is measured in something called FLOPS, which is floating point operations per second. And this is the number of mathematical operations that a computer can churn out over time. So the current best computers can work at something that's called a petaflop, or 11 petaflops in the case of the very best machine. And that is 10 to the 15th flops. And so an exascale is the next major jump, and so that would be 10 to the 18th flops, and that's just an extraordinary amount of supercomputing power.
It does sound like a very powerful machine. What kinds of computations would this next step of computers be used for?
Well, they would be able to do what the current ones can do, but just a lot better and faster and in more detail. So current supercomputers are used for a wide variety of things. Things like climate modeling that can model the entire atmosphere and watch it as it might evolve over time. Design novel products such as new highly efficient engines that can burn novel biofuels or something like that. They model chemical reactions, all kinds of things. So what supercomputers are really fantastic at doing is essentially carrying out experiments on things that are very difficult to experiment with. So, for example, some astrophysicists use them to experiment with how a supernova might explode. And you can't just go, you know, somewhere and check out a supernova anytime you want. You have to actually run these things. If you want to learn about the details of it, you actually have to model it on a computer.
Well, I've heard a lot about the problems of making smaller devices, like smartphones, things like that. What are some of the challenges to creating a really, really big computer?
There are a lot of them, and I'll try to simplify this as much as possible. Some of the problems on making big computers is actually the same as the ones in making very small devices, and that is in making them efficient so they don't use much power. Power is the major challenge with supercomputers, and that's because as the machines get bigger, they use more and more power. Today's top-of-the-line machine uses about 10 megawatts of power. That's enough to heat or run 10,000 homes. Future exascale machines, if they continue the current trends, would use about 200 megawatts.
Wow.
So enough to power 200,000 homes. That's about the size of what a nuclear plant might put out. So they're going to probably aim for something like using 20 megawatts of power, mm-hmm. which means they have to get a whole lot more efficient. So computers, whether they are just a laptop or a supercomputer, there's a few basic components that aren't all that different, actually, between all these different kinds of computers. There's the brains. These are the chips people refer to, or the CPUs. These are central processing units, and there's other kinds of chips as well. There is memory, which stores all the data and then feeds it to the processors. And there are wires that connect everything up. You know, sometimes they're metal wires, or other times they're optical connections. All of these things take power, and so they are all big power drains, so folks are trying to come up with efficient designs on all of those. In the history of computing, there's always been a drive to get better, bigger, stronger, faster machines. And there's been two ways to do this historically with the processor chips, and these are the brains of the machine. So you can either just make a chip that runs faster, it's able to operate at a higher frequency, and that way the chip can just churn through more calculations faster. And all the way up until around 2000, that's what companies did. They made smaller and smaller transistors and other devices on their chips. Those worked faster. The problem with that is if you want to double the frequency of a chip, the power usage will go up eightfold.
Mm.
So around the year 2000, companies started figuring out that they couldn't keep doubling the frequency of their chips. Instead, what they did is they started adding multiple processors on a single chip. Now, these they call cores. So now you'll see ads for a laptop that might have a chip with a 4-core or 8-core or something like that. Well, that trend has swept through supercomputers as well. So the world's fastest machine now has 705,000 cores. And as supercomputer makers look towards the exascale, they think that they might have chips with 100 million or even a billion cores in them. And so they have to figure out how to design those and make use of them and have them be efficient. And then a final problem is just memory. As you increase the number of processors, you also have to increase the amount of memory that you put into a machine. And that's getting really expensive as well. And it's causing more data movement problems and things like that. So all these things are sort of piling on one another and has people sort of scratching their heads about how to solve some of these problems.
So you're saying that there's a lot of different places that change needs to be made, both in how power is handled, how memory is handled. What kinds of tactics are being considered?
So one of them is designing chips that aren't just multi-core, which we have now, which might have 4 or 8 processors or something like that, but they would be called many-core chips. They have specialty processors alongside the general processors. So you might have hundreds of cores on one chip. It would have a mix of different kinds of processors, and overall, that would make it more efficient to handle certain problems by sending certain kinds of mathematical operations to certain processors. So that's one strategy for improving the efficiency of the chips themselves. There's strategies for improving the memory by stacking memory chips on top of one another and running communications and data lines and power lines up through them to minimize the distance the data has to travel. On the software side of things, the Department of Energy, which is currently in the United States spearheading the efforts to design an exascale machine, has set up something they're calling co-design centers. They've set up 3 of them, and that has software experts working together with hardware experts to design the machines from the ground up in a way that will make them the most efficient possible. So that's an attempt to improve how the software will work on them. So there's people are already exploring quite a different number of options, but people haven't settled on a final design of what an exascale machine might look like.
It seems that the machines available now use an incredible amount of energy and are very expensive to run. Who's going to pay for these even more powerful exascale computers?
In the United States, the DOE is really spearheading the effort from both a defense standpoint and as well as the scientific agencies. The United States is going to have plenty of company trying to build an exascale machine. So China, Japan, India, Russia, the European Union have all discussed making a big push on an exascale machine, but nobody has released detailed plans yet, but it's sure to be a big race. And it's not just for bragging rights, because there's lots of value that you can get out of these machines. Something like 57% of all supercomputer use now is by industry. So countries are building these machines hoping to give their homegrown industries a leg up. And probably the most obvious example of industries that stand to benefit is our chip-making companies like Intel or AMD or something like that. Supercomputers really are the cutting edge of computing technology. And so companies are very interested in participating in these research programs because it helps them work out what their products that most of us will be buying for desktops and laptops or whatever in 10 or 15 years, it helps them work through that technology ahead of time and in some senses get a leg up on the competition. So countries are very interested in supporting high-performance computing as a way of giving their businesses an advantage.
Well, Bob Service, thanks for talking with me today.
You're welcome.
Robert Service writes about the next steps in supercomputing in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So first up, we have a new use for embryonic stem cells.
Right. Carrie, this story deals with the controversial and often very struggling field of human embryonic stem cell research. And when researchers first started working with stem cells, they were very excited because especially embryonic stem cells can theoretically differentiate into any type of cell in the body. So researchers thought that by working with embryonic stem cells, they could turn it into something maybe like an insulin-producing cell, put it into somebody who has diabetes, and all of a sudden they'd be cured of diabetes. Well, things haven't really turned out that way. First of all, these cells have proven a lot harder to work with than scientists originally thought. Also, there's been a lot of controversy in the field because some people don't like the idea that these cells are often derived from human embryos. What's special about this new study is it's actually the first published results from a clinical trial using human embryonic stem cells. And so it's a real important milestone for the field. It's showing that not only can these cells be used, but they can also be somewhat effective.
And so these in particular were used in treating eye disease. Which diseases are we talking about?
Well, the trial was very small. It was only two patients. And one of them was a woman in her 50s who had macular degeneration. And this is a degeneration of your vision that can occur as you grow older. Another one had just a rare inherited disease that was causing her to be almost blind. And what the researchers did was they took human embryonic stem cells, and they made them turn into what are called retinal pigment epithelium cells. And these are cells that help us see. And they basically just injected these cells into the eyes of the two patients and monitored their progress over the course of several weeks. And one of the really important things they found was that the patients didn't seem to have any adverse side effects. Now, when researchers have used human embryonic stem cells in other animal models, these cells have sometimes turned into tumors, abnormal growths, caused other problems. But the researchers didn't see any of that in the two patients. And what was also really interesting was the researchers actually saw an improvement of vision in both patients. Now, it wasn't a dramatic improvement in vision, but for example, one of the women could only see hand movements before she got the treatment. And a few weeks after she got the treatment, she was actually able to read a few letters on an eye chart. So it wasn't like her vision was magically restored, but it certainly seemed to get better.
Well, the researchers in this study seem very cautious about the results here.
Why are they not glowingly excited about this?
Well, first of all, it's a very small trial, only two patients, so it's hard to make big conclusions over such a small trial. Also, the field has just been plagued with so many problems that they don't want to get overexcited. They really want to do a lot more work, a lot more safety work has to be done. And also, you know, again, this wasn't a dramatic improvement in vision, so there may be better ways to do this treatment. Maybe the researchers can find a better way of actually getting the cells into the eye or other ways to sort of improve how a therapy like this would work.
All right. And next, this is your brain on drugs.
Right. This is your brain on psychedelic drugs specifically. And the drugs we're talking about here are magic mushrooms. And the active ingredient in these magic mushrooms is a drug called psilocybin. And for anybody who's taken magic mushrooms, I can't speak from personal experience, but, you know, these types of drugs cause very hallucinogenic experiences, out-of-body experiences, sometimes very religious experiences people have when they're on these drugs. And this new study is trying to figure out, why does all of this happen? What is happening in people's brains when they take these drugs?
So how do they tackle that?
Well, surprisingly, they didn't actually give people magic mushrooms. They wanted the effect to be very short and very quick. And so what they did was they actually took psilocybin and they injected it intravenously into a few patients that were sitting in an fMRI scanner. An fMRI is basically a machine that measures activity in the brain. And so what the researchers did was they gave the drugs and they looked at the brain activity of these patients. And what was really surprising, what they found, is a lot of researchers had speculated that magic mushrooms or psilocybin overstimulated the brain so that, you know, all the experiences we usually had were just much more intense than usual. But they found the opposite. They found that psilocybin actually seems to shut off certain parts of the brain, specifically activity to the posterior cingulate cortex and the medial prefrontal cortex. Now, both of these regions are involved in what's called the default mode network of the brain. This is a region that's involved when our minds wander. They're also thought to be involved in generating our sense of consciousness and just sort of who we are and our surroundings. So you can imagine if you start turning our sense of consciousness off, then your brain will perhaps start to invent curious realities, which is sort of what a lot of people experience when they take these drugs.
So what does this all say about the potential therapeutic use of these hallucinogenic chemicals?
Well, it's a great question because these drugs aren't just taken recreationally. Scientists really want to try to use them therapeutically. And there's been suggestions that they could be used to treat people with several types of mental illness, including depression and anxiety. Scientists are also very interested in figuring out the neural basis of spirituality. Why are some people much more religious than others? And because a lot of people have religious experiences while taking these drugs could really shed light on what's going on in our brain when we have these types of experiences. So now that they know a little bit more about how these drugs work, they may be a bit closer to answering those questions.
Wow, how interesting. And our third story today sounds a little bit like the title of a Philip K. Dick novel.
Right. We titled it Do Dolphins Speak Whale in Their Sleep? And it's also maybe the title of a bit of a hallucinogenic experience, if you want to call back to the last item we talked about. But basically, this is a very curious finding from a marine park in France. And what researchers found was that a bunch of dolphins in this marine park were making strange noises in the middle of the night. They had put these underwater microphones in the water to just sort of listen to what the dolphins were doing at night. And this is what they heard.
All right, so that's an interesting noise. To my human ears, I wouldn't know that that isn't normal, but what do scientists think that that sounds like?
Well, what the researchers thought was, you know, this sounds a lot like whale noises, but they didn't trust their own ears. So what they did was they ran these noises through a computer program that compared them to a variety of other sounds, and the computer program essentially spit out that indeed these sounds were very similar to whale sounds.
And they say that this isn't just any whale song, but it's actually something that the dolphins had already heard earlier that day.
Right. The dolphins aren't just making up whale sounds. When they have their performances during the day, the marine park actually blares this soundtrack that includes music, seagulls' calls, and humpback whale calls. And so the dolphins are actually hearing these sounds during the day, even though they're not coming from actual whales, they're coming from this soundtrack. And they seem to be repeating them at night.
So the significance here isn't just that it's whale noises that they're purportedly singing, but also that they're actually remembering sounds that they had heard earlier in time?
Exactly. Dolphins have been shown before to mimic whale noises, so that's not new. What's new is that they're mimicking them so much later in the day. It's almost like they're trying to process them or they're trying to remember them. What's also interesting is that the whale sounds are being played during a sort of a learning part of the dolphin's day. They're learning new tricks. They're performing new tricks. And so they may be sort of incorporating this into their repertoire. Hey, that's something else I've got to learn. That's something I've got to study. And so at night when either they're sleeping or they're just sort of hanging out, they're repeating these sounds as a way to maybe encode new memories.
Well, so it sounds like this noise sounds a whole lot like the whale song that they hear earlier, but are we 100% positive that that's really what this is?
We're not 100% positive, and actually neither are the researchers. Even after they ran the computer program, they actually asked 20 human volunteers to see whether they thought these were whale sounds, and about 76% of the time, the volunteers classified the imitations as sounds from real whales. So even to our own ears, it sounds like whales, but still, that's not enough. In fact, one expert quoted in the study says that he's heard a lot of sounds that dolphins make in the wild that sound like they might be coming from whales, but they're actually not. So this is still sort of an open question about what these dolphins are actually speaking at night, whether they're speaking whale or maybe just speaking some other form of dolphinese.
All right. So what else have we had online this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about jumping spiders, also a story about the North Star and whether it might be wasting away. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about a researcher accusing scientists of misconduct over YouTube. We're also continuing our coverage of the controversial avian flu papers. There's a lot of controversy about two recent papers, whether they should be published in their entirety, and what are the implications for biosecurity. So be sure to check that out on Science Insider. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's chat is about the science of anti-aging. What are scientists learning about how to keep our bodies younger? And next week's chat is about peak oil. Is the well starting to run dry for the global oil supply? So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
I certainly will. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the January 27th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.